As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, FA Cup. Iheanacho, man of the macho, as Leicester put out Man United, Saints, Man City and Chelsea also through. Premier League, Newcastle flagging like an MP on breakfast TV. Villa Spurs just put something like job done. And drama at the London Stadium with OGs and OGs as West Ham let a 3-goal lead slip against the Gunners. We look back on all of that and get a cheeky look ahead to the weekend's international games too. Ooh, it's the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Yes, it is, listener, and thank you so much for being with us on this Monday, the 22nd of March, or any day of your choosing thereafter. Dust has settled on a busy weekend across various competitions, and we're joined by Daniel Story. Lovely to see you, Daniel.
Hi, James.
Great to have Dion Fanning with us as well. Hello, Dion.
Hi, James.
Hello to you, and whoop, whoop, it's the sound of the David Priest. Hello, the David Priest.
Yeah. Good evening, hello. James, yeah. Good.
David, where are you calling from?
Does it sound like I'm far away?
Well, yeah, it does. Where are you?
I'm just in Lincoln, not too far away.
Well, that's quite far, isn't it? No longer in Nordic lands.
No, I'm back home now. Right. Cut short my contract by a year, so it's time to come back now, I think. Time to come back.
Time to come home. All right. Have you had your brain octane oil?
What's that?
Oh, it's just part of, you know, a modern kind of preparation for a busy week ahead. Some green powders, brain octane oil, no tracksuit bottoms, that kind of thing. That was probably one of the highlights of the weekend. Daniel, what would be your highlight of the weekend?
I think Brighton Newcastle was the game of the weekend, and therefore it needed an emphatic result, I think, for both teams to stop it kind of lingering on for 2 weeks and nobody really knowing where anyone stood. Now we know where those two sides stand, and a kind of such an emphatic win, and a win that kind of felt more than just 3 points, 3 goals.
Mm-hmm. Kind of performance Seagulls supporters have been dreaming of. Do we know where Arsenal and West Ham stand now, Dion?
I don't know if we do. I would say that was the game of the weekend. But we might get into this a bit more, but controversially, I'm always a bit sceptical of how impressive it is when teams come from 3-0 down. I think there's something, what do the Americans call it, garbage time. And I think there's something in that. So
why garbage time?
Because when you're losing 3-0, you don't have anything. It's much easier to play when you're 3-0 down than it is when it's 0-0 or 1-0. So Arsenal are able to get back into the game at a point where the pressure is off in some ways.
Right. Well, it's the new very dangerous scoreline, isn't it, being 3-0 up? It's happened a number of times. It's the third time this season in the Premier League that a team have been 3 goals to the good and ended up drawing 3-3. Anyway, we'll touch on that and much more. In deference to its venerable status, shall we begin with the FA Cup?
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
It was the quarterfinals this weekend. What happened? Saturday, the only team yet to concede a goal in this year's competition sailed on. That's Saints, of course, who were 3-0 winners at Bournemouth. Man City, meanwhile, taking 84 minutes to find a way past Everton, but running out 2-0 winners. Same scoreline for Chelsea on Sunday, but they did have some scares in the second half against Sheffield United. While at the King Power Sunday afternoon, Leicester picked at a loose thread and United came apart at the seams. 3-1 the score there. The draw, which was made at half-time at the King Power, sees Saints taking on Leicester in the semi-finals. Not sure if there have been any previous games between those two that we should mention. And also, in the other semi-final, Chelsea get to take on Man City and try and deny them a quadruple. Crikey. Hmm. David, what did you watch of any of that?
Well, the one game that I took real notice of was today's game, Leicester and Man United. I thought it was typical of Manchester United in many ways and typical of Leicester. I think the difference between the two teams was the managers right from the off. I think, you know, you look at Leicester City today and you see they had a game plan, they had like a structure, the way they were going to approach the game, and it paid off. None more so than when they pressed to get the first goal and United played straight in their hands. And I don't know about yous, but I watch United over the last couple of seasons and you often get these up and down results because they don't seem to have any methodology behind the way they play. Some people saw them as a counter-attacking team where they've got lightning quick attackers that they can break on teams very quickly and take advantage of a really strong forward line. But I think that's when they come up against the likes of Leicester and Brendan Rodgers, when they have come up with a plan to deal with them, they don't have any answer. And of course, the European game during the week, that can take its toll as well. And maybe it was a case for resting more players, but...
Or not resting the players that they rested. That's a subject close to Daniel's heart. But before we get to United, Leicester... So much fun in this game, and so much for this late season collapse that a lot of us were anticipating, particularly without Maddison and Barnes.
Yeah, well, the late season collapse doesn't look like it's happening, but I still would separate to some degree whatever Leicester are going to do in the cup, and reaching the semi-final is great for them. But the season still, the late season collapse or not, still depends on where Leicester finish in the Premier League, I think. So I think this is an important result for them in terms of, continuing to demonstrate that they're sustaining something. But I don't think this is the most important game of Leicester's season, or that these are the games, the cup games are the games that will define their season.
Are you with Ollie with his cup games are for egotists philosophy?
I am. Well, I think I am, and I wonder what could he be looking back on the recent history of Manchester United and recalling that Louis van Gaal was sacked hours after winning the FA Cup. So whether it's for egotists or not, it doesn't actually do you any good as manager of Manchester United to win silverware, if the silverware is the FA Cup or the Carabao Cup. And so I think that's one of the issues when people talk. And I think it's kind of, people talk, managers need to win silverware. And I actually think sometimes it's a bit of an insult to supporters, because supporters can actually see, especially these days, they can see, as David said, that there are things that supporters look for now that go beyond maybe a cup especially. And they are, a sign that a team is progressing, a team that's going to finish in the top four, which is much more important for Manchester United.
Right.
And they're the things. I actually don't think they're things that you can actually say Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is necessarily doing. I agree with David on that. But I wouldn't say that not winning silverware is something to condemn him for.
At the risk of talking about Leicester again, though, are they not in a position to be enjoying both at this point? Because comfortably in the top four and through to a semi-final. Can we have some love for the extraordinary Iheanacho? 9 goals now in 9 games. Man City will be rueing the day they let him slip away.
It just shows what a bit of confidence can do. I liked before the game that he came out and, someone fed him the very obvious question of, you play for Man City and this is Manchester United and, does this mean it means more? And normally you get the standard answer, well, I'm in form and you're trying every game, yada, yada, yada. And actually he said, yeah, it does. It means that I really have an extra reason, and I'll probably try even harder to beat them, and therefore scoring two goals. You know, he's clearly absolutely brilliant, and he's on fire. And we discussed it last week when we said that, you know, Rodgers deserves huge credit for playing this two striker formation to try and ostensibly to try and get more out of Jamie Vardy, and actually it's not sparked Vardy into scoring. He didn't score against Day. He's eight games without a goal, but Ian Acho is the one reaping the rewards.
I think it's I don't know whether I'm oversimplifying things here, but it was interesting listening to Tielemans talking after the game about Ian Acho and about how sort of how quiet he is and sort of very sort of introverted, and converting that onto the pitch when he's playing up front by himself, when he's replacing like for like for Jamie Vardy, it's kind of it's a big responsibility shoulder. When he's being put up there with Jamie Vardy and they're working as a pair, and the focus isn't just on him to be scoring the goals, I think that's helping them massively.
Anybody else you want to pick out from Leicester? Soyuncu, Tielemans you mentioned. Who else caught your eye from the Foxes?
The risk of being controversial given Jamie Vardy's last few seasons, I think Wilfred Ndidi is their best player. There's both him and Yves Bissouma this weekend who have both produced absolutely extraordinarily consistent performances, which is just being in the right place at the right time, every time. And as soon as they get the ball, they recycle it pretty simply, but their job's done at that point. And both of them have this Kante-esque ability that every time you want them to be in a place, they're there. And I think there's a kind of risk with those players of assuming it's because they're herring around everywhere. It's not really about that. It's about the perception. It's about the reading of the game. And Bissouma's only 24. I think Ndidi's about the same. And they're pretty kind of extraordinarily complete midfielders for that age. Manchester United would be vastly improved by signing either of them, because Fred is at the moment is a kind of walking accident in that he does eight things well and two things very badly, which at Manchester United isn't good enough.
I think Fofana as well has been exceptional. Like, he's another exceptional game today, and it's that thing that Leicester have, that the players that are coming through there now, they all seem attractive to other clubs. But what it tells you is that there is a structure. You look at the amount of players that have, the people say they would do well at a more established club. But that's because of what they have created there. So there are players coming along and prospering. And he's another. I thought Fofana was exceptional today.
There'll be the usual rotation of guilty parties that will have their finger pointed at them from United's point of view, whether it's Fred or Martial, who's coming in for a lot of criticism for his lack of performance in the kind of central striker role. But Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, something, Daniel, that you were talking about, was this curious approach to resting Bruno Fernandes, in that he didn't when he needed a rest against Real Sociedad, and then he did today. Solskjaer will have had a motive for leaving out of the starting lineup, but what do you think it might have been?
Well, he says he isn't tired, and Bruno says he isn't tired. And I mean, maybe he always planned to rest him in this game, although that seems a really strange decision from my part, whether he believes, you know, whether he believes trophies are for egotists or not. But the fact he also rested Luke Shaw, who's been probably their second best player this season, suggests that there was a deliberate rotation policy, which seems a bizarre thing to do in a really difficult FA Cup quarter-final. You know, Man United picked really strong teams in the previous rounds, which then makes it seem really odd when, you know, one of the hardest games in that competition you could face, and you then rest players.
Oh, in front of an international weekend as well.
Yeah, I mean, Solskjaer did, you know, a couple of weeks ago, kind of intimated that he might be able to pull out Bruno from international duty because of the quarantining rules. Portugal have picked him. So the international break as a rest is, I think, a bit of a misnomer, because he could play three games in the next 2 weeks for Portugal. So, but still, if Bruno says he's not tired and Solskjaer says he's not tired, I don't know why today is the game he doesn't play.
Okay. One other thing on United, unless there's other things you want to throw in, but John Sands asking, is Donny van de Beek the most disappointing major signing of the last summer window? Havertz and Werner run him close, suggests John Sands. What do you think, van de Beek?
I think there's probably more potential for Havertz and Werner to actually improve, and especially the way Chelsea are going. I think there is that there is an opportunity for them to fit into that system, whereas for him it hasn't worked. And whether that's his fault or whether it's the, again, a club like United, which who still don't really make signings in a sort of holistic way, where they understand what every player is going to do. But I think it hasn't worked for him.
I think that's a real good point, that, because it just smacks of buying a very good player and then trying to fit him in rather than buying him for a role. From the very off, you know, he's come from very high expectations from coming from Ajax and doing very well there, and then coming sitting on the bench, and then there's a big focus on him, and it's just been a downward curve for him.
He's not the first player to leave Ajax and fail to live up to the hype elsewhere. You could argue that Matthijs de Ligt has had similar issues at the back for Juventus, but he's a midfielder and he's playing in midfield. So explain it to the thickies like me at the back. What is so very different about what he gets asked to do at Man United to what he was excelling at for the Amsterdam Giants?
Well, Ajax essentially play this possession-based system, which is based on kind of some pass and move and fairly patient play that then builds up to this kind of crescendo of faster play. Manchester United are almost the opposite in that they look to invite teams on and then at their best, as David said earlier, counter-attack at lightning speed, which, I mean, that's almost the opposite of Van der Beek's game. You know, I'm sure every high-class player can play that over time, but it seems an extraordinary decision to pay X million pounds on a player and then say, right, well, we like what you did before and now we're going to try and make you play the opposite way for in a completely different system. As both Dion and David have said, you're buying a player and then trying to immediately change him. You don't do that with, you know, good clubs don't do that. Manchester City saw a need for Ruben Dias. They brought in exactly the player they wanted. Leicester saw a player in Wesley Fofana that they thought could be exactly what they wanted in a central defender. They didn't suddenly ask him to play a completely different way. And it's just very strange.
Mm. How confident are you that the recent changes to the setup at Man United are going to make a difference on this? Daniel's frowning, wincing.
No, I mean, to me, it smacked of, and I may well be wrong here, but it smacked of business as usual, basically. I don't want to say jobs for the boys, because that's incredibly unfair on the people that have got the jobs. I think they're probably good. I think Darren Fletcher is probably very good at what he will do. But while you still have that committee, which effectively leaves Ed Woodward in transfer charge, then I think it feels a little bit like deck chair rearranging.
All right. Well, in the meantime, Man United exit the competition. Leicester go through to the semi-final. They've never won the FA Cup, of course. Haven't reached the final since 1969. They may fancy their chances this time as they take on a Saints team who themselves bounce back from their recent slumps with a 3-0 victory over Bournemouth. There was much comment in the Match of the Day coverage. I don't know if you saw this on Saturday night when they were at the site of Bournemouth's pre-game huddle. Firstly, because Jack Wilshere was in it, and I completely forgot that he was there at the Vitality Stadium, but also because body language, it just spoke of the wrong approach from the team, and that certainly seemed to be manifested in the scoreline. Nathan Redmond, the star here, with two goals and an assist, and generally looking electric. Hasenhüttl was asked afterwards why he doesn't do that more often. He didn't have an answer. Do you guys?
He's one of those players who hit on the scene and had, I mean, he had bags of pace when he was at Birmingham. And very similar, actually, to Demarai Gray, in that what got them there hasn't really kicked on. You know, sometimes it's those players who are really strong physically when they're young, who then when they go and play at a higher level, they don't really have that dominance that they had when they were growing up to gain the reputation. With them, it's almost the opposite. It's the speed that it just doesn't seem to have given them enough else. I mean, Redmond was incredibly highly rated at Birmingham. So was Demarai Gray. And yeah, I mean, I'm just looking now. I mean, he has got an England cap, which I was just checking. I thought he had one, and he does have one, which it just seems that he's a world away from that now. And yet he's not, you know, he's not old yet. He's just not 22 years old anymore. And therefore it's not potential. It needs to be actual consistent ability. He just really performs in flashes, which is a bit of a shame.
Place your bets. Welcome to Pep Roulette. Sir, I'm feeling confident today, me.
So your selection, sir?
To start up front, blue number 9 and 10, 17 as well, just behind the front two.
Good luck, sir. Blue number 7, unlucky, sir.
Sterling? He started last week.
Predicting Pep's lineups can be tricky these days, but fortunately with Paddy Power's Acca offer, if you don't get one leg of your 4+-fold Acca right, we'll give you your money back as a free bet. Paddy Power!
Max free bet £10, min odds 1 to 5 on each leg. Online exclusive, exclude shop bets, excludes enhanced match odds, T's and C's apply, 18+, begambleaware.org.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the team's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new, Thursdays on FX, stream on Hulu.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
The other side of the road to Wembley, although that's where obviously they'll already be for the semi-finals, is Man City against Chelsea. Crikey. What do you think of Chelsea's chances of stopping Man City? Dion?
I think they have a chance. I think there's Chelsea are becoming, you know, we've seen what has happened there. You know, defensively, they've become very, very solid. They were a bit fortunate against Sheffield United. David McGoldrick, like that was an astonishing, really astonishing miss. And Sheffield United kept getting chances. They, you know, they had other, like Brewster at the end even had a great chance, which, you know, he went for a corner, but actually he should have scored. Like he should have scored that as well. But obviously McGoldrick's chance was the best one, and Chelsea were kind of hanging on a little bit. But I think they will, in the cup with City stretched in all competitions, Chelsea will have a chance, I think.
It was a remarkable second half actually from Sheffield United, who have now lost more games than they have scored goals this campaign. That's 24 defeats and just the 23 goals, but they came very close, as you say, on several occasions there in quite a turnaround and quite a surprise, I think, for those of us who felt that the Blades would probably collapse without Chris Wilder.
Yeah, I think the biggest problem that Paul Heckenbottom's faced since he's been in was to try and, as he said, put smiles on faces. Of course, it's more than that. You know, they were a very downbeat sort of group the last week or so. It hit the team hard, obviously. But it was a case of maybe it's more the what he was going to do in the pitch. It was to try and just to get them to play together as a team and to try and put that to the side and just move on a little bit. And I think that he'll be encouraged certainly by the second half performance, because I know that way that Paul wants to play. He's I've known him since we were summoned together a long time ago, and you know, the way that he set up his teams when he was taking a coaching degree at Leeds Uni, and he did his thesis on it was on the early years of Simeone at Atletico. And it was kind of like how he sort of he approached the game when he was at Barnsley, and you could see a bit of that today. You know, they were a bit physical. There was people complaining that they were a little over physical, but sometimes it takes something like that to galvanise a team or to you know, to raise the intensity in the game. And certainly, although this is a Chelsea side that was much changed and, you know, maybe is a little bit disjointed, you know, they can take great heart from the second half performance. And like you said, they should have gotten something more out of the game.
Or at least extra time, if nothing else, which seemed to be very much the target for Everton in their clash with Man City. And they very nearly got the prize of an extra 30 minutes defending against Man City. 84 minutes they held out for. And then Gundogan again. And Kevin De Bruyne had come on and made quite a difference. Fair enough, really, from Carlo, is it, against this Man City? What else are you going to do?
Yeah, I mean, although it was almost an embarrassing mismatch in the first half an hour. I think 25 minutes or 30 minutes in, it was 207 passes completed versus 16 passes completed, which...
Seriously?
Yeah, which kind of indicates that the way Everton were playing. But yeah, they just completely sacrificed possession and said, you know, we can quite easily lose the game in the first 30 minutes, so let's just try and stick in. And the problem with that approach is that City are so good that as soon as you switch off for a minute, it's pass, 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 and you're through. And the goal had a little bit of fortune. It was kind of really unfortunate on the goalkeeper, who obviously is the third choice goalkeeper, reacts really well to the deflection and tips the ball onto the bar. And obviously Gundogan's just there to kind of stoop diving header in. And yeah, and at that point, it's very, very hard to change gear and suddenly decide you're going to attack for the last 7 minutes because you've not tried for the rest of the game.
Right, and then De Bruyne finishes you off with a rocket. Obligatory goalkeeper question for you, David Priest. What did you make of João Virginia?
Yeah, I think it was a tough. It was tough when he first came against Burnley. You know, when it's your debut and he comes after 48 minutes, and he did look a little bit nervy in that game. But I think the game yesterday have done the world of good. A couple of great saves. There was another one from Raheem Sterling that he just tips it away, and he's going to need that kind of confidence come from those performances if he's going to continue in goal.
Dion, how tremulously do you anticipate this golden dawn of Man City becoming the first ever quadruple winners? Is that, would it be amazing or really not amazing for the game?
I think it would be probably depressing when we've seen what happened with some of City's kind of cup, you know, their FA Cup triumph before, when City actually, sometimes when they reveal how dominant they are, it is quite depressing. I think from City's point of view, again, to go back to the silverware question, the only one that really matters to them is the Champions League. I think of all of them, that's the one that matters. The others really won't make much of a difference.
Really? Now that they're in this position, though, do you not think they care pretty strongly about not getting beaten by any of them, by Spurs in the League Cup final and Chelsea in this FA Cup semi?
They would rather lose the FA Cup semi-final and the League Cup final if it's guaranteed than winning the Champions League, yeah.
Yeah, no, if they had to pick one, if you're going to do that kind of Meryl Streep-esque, you know. But Mike, from a supporter's point of view, it would be a remarkable achievement, and it's spoken of in kind of reverential tones. They could do the quadruple. But when you see them this dominant against, you know, a decent Premier League side like Everton, it would be quite a depressing thing to have them just hoover everything up in one season.
It's depressing when you see that, you know, teams setting up like against them like Everton did. And if you're going to concede, you know, or only have 26% of possession, you've got to be near faultless or absolutely faultless to get anything out of the game, whether it be, and that might be just a draw. And I think that's the game against Chelsea. They're only going to be the only team that that can challenge them, really, because they'll obviously take more of the ball as well. And Tuchel's, he's proved himself to be a canny operator now, hasn't he?
No, he certainly has.
I'd say the only thing that makes it astonishing to me this season is that they were eighth at the turn of the year in the Premier League. That's the remarkable thing, that this kind of this dominance, this complete serene dominance, actually came out of what was being perceived as a bit of a crisis. I agree that them winning every trophy most seasons is not a particularly good look for kind of financially engorged leagues, but I don't think we can doubt the fact that, you know, at the start, it's only 4 or 5 months since people were saying, is Pep Guardiola finished at Manchester City?
Yeah, I think that makes it at least a bit more interesting, because there has been this sense, you know, we started the season, as Daniel said, people talking about this, and this is the end for Pep at City, and it was going to, you know, be a sort of slightly dismal wind down of his time. And then now we're talking about this team whose absolute dominance will cast a cloud over football for a generation. So it's... Yep.
I'm guilty of both those statements. It's true. And it does beg the question of why I turn up for the first half of the season, because it plainly has no relevance to what actually happens. We had City were down 8th, 9th, 10th at one point. Saints were leading the table. I mean, the whole thing's just... Yes, anyway. Well, That's the FA Cup then. But as we head towards the sharp end of the season, it's a time for big cup clashes.
Coming soon. Questions.
So the choice was Kaiserslautern or Eintracht Frankfurt.
Answers.
I'm going to go for Eintracht Frankfurt.
Dirty tricks.
Oh, well, I'm going to do that horrible thing of saying 90,001.
Agony.
I think James summed it up. You sly, sly dog.
Ecstasy.
James Horncastle, you're in the quarterfinals. How do you feel?
See you!
And some filthy, filthy sounds.
Wow. Ooh.
The Intertotally Cup. Rebooted, bigger and badder than ever, and coming very, very soon.
Yeah, the Intertotally Cup is back on Thursday, apparently. So if you were thinking of skipping out on our pre-international weekend Thursday Totally show, don't. Because it's back up and running. Oh, we have with us last year's runner-up, Daniel Storey. What kind of training regime have you been on in the months?
I mean, I haven't yet replied to Nick Miller's WhatsApp message. So
have you not?
That's the level of training I've done so far.
Right. Okay.
I will.
You've probably got multiple competitions to juggle, no?
Yes.
Something like that. Excellent. Okay. Well, anyway, yes. Yeah, so the Intertotally Cup returns on Thursday, which is nice. Now, shall we move on to the Premier League? It was a big weekend. Let's see what happened. There was a great result for Newcastle. That was Fulham getting beaten by Leeds. The Magpies themselves collapsed 3-0 away at Brighton, a result which moves the Seagulls 6 points clear now of the drop. Further up the table, Spurs had a 2-0 win at Villa, while a hugely entertaining game Sunday afternoon at the London Stadium saw West Ham racing to a 3-goal lead against Arsenal in the first half hour and then scoring 2 own goals to let the Gunners back into it before Lacazette grabbed an equaliser. What a game. Dion, I think you were calling this the game of the weekend. I'm not going to argue.
No, it was fantastic. Like West Ham seemed to be, you know, again, just, you know, asserting that the sort of the return, the rise, the unstoppable rise of David Moyes. And then, as I said earlier, Arsenal got back into it. What you can read into that, I'm not so sure, but it's it was a very good and very important point for them, I think, and a good to get back, especially after last weekend as well. It is important for them.
Well, it was a massive week. They had the victory over their traditional rivals, Olympiacos, and before that, the North London derby as well. And maybe they were a little bit sleepy at the start. Was that what West Ham took advantage of, particularly the excellent Jesse Lingard with that snappy free kick?
Yeah, it was criminal, wasn't it? Everyone just went to sleep on the free kick, turned the backs. It was really clever by Jesse Lingard. Even Arsenal's goal in the second half, it was almost similar where Arsenal get the free kick and they take it quickly and they score a goal from it. It seemed a bit of a game for that, but it's Arsenal are just a strange side because you expect them to lose 3-0 leads, not to come back from it. But at the same time, you can still see that they're sort of flakiness like that. This is typical of them. And as Dion pointed out at the start of the programme, it's a lot easier to come back and start playing when you're already 2 or 3 goals down. Pressure's off you. And I think they'll be feeling that as well. The manager will be know that as well. You can give them credit for coming back into it. But of course, that's when the pressure's off. It's easy to play when it's like that.
It's even easier when your opposition give to you couple of own goals as well to get you on your way. Typical Arsenal perhaps, but typical West Ham. Our pal Benji Leniardo tweeting when they were 3-1 up, a core defining part of being a Hammers fan is the deep understanding that we probably won't win this, and so it proved. But before we get on to that, can we just quickly touch on Jesse Lingard? I know that everyone's kind of had a comment or two about how nice it is to see him back and flourishing under David Moyes' tutelage. But what exactly had they done to him at United? He was so good when he started there, and then he became this kind of living meme. He hadn't scored in the whole of 2019. And he hits a new club, and all of a sudden, boom, he's off again.
I think there's clearly a lifting of a bit of a weight there. There's an awful lot of pressure and responsibility and scrutiny, I think, when you're at a club like Manchester United, especially a player like Lingard, who was aware of that responsibility. And I think through no fault of his own a lot of the time, it's hard to kind of sustain it with that pressure on you. Now, you know, the one thing you always have to avoid with Lingard, and it's kind of interesting now, at United he was always kind of referred to as, you know, a young player, even as he kind of hit his mid-20s and went way beyond the stage of being what we would consider a young player. But that kind of told part of the problem, because it reveals a kind of mindset about what you should be as a Manchester United player. And at West Ham, he's become, you know, very quickly become a mature player, and a player who's been handed responsibility and is taking that responsibility.
I think he's the fourth oldest player in the latest England squad, which is remarkable, really, given, Kyle Walker and Harry Maguire are definitely older than him. And I think one of the good, Nick Pope is as well, but I think that's it, which is really odd. And he also has a manager in David Moyes who he did play pretty well for at Manchester United. You know, Manchester United weren't a great side at that point, but Lingard was getting minutes at that point. So I think by all accounts, that squad has got a really good kind of shared spirit at the moment. And if Lingard is good at one thing, it's that he gets on with people. You know, he players like him. All the Manchester United players really liked him. You know, when he saw them before and after the game, when they played each other recently, you know, he embraced all of them, and they all, you know, they're his mates. So I think he's a very easy player to parachute into a squad and get along with everyone pretty well, which helps.
Mm. All right. It also helps when he scores opening goals like the wonderful strike he got things underway with in this. And then it was the clever work to set up Bowen for the second. Suchet grabbing a third before Arsenal began their comeback. In terms of our desire to pinpoint progress by young managers like Arteta, are there any conclusions we can draw from Arsenal's second half?
Just to counter the argument of what I was saying before about, you know, that it's easier to play when they're 3-0 down, but also it is a 90-minute game. People forget that as well, you know, and it's you don't win any prizes at half-time. And Arteta's maybe in an easy position at half time to be able to change things and to make his decisions a little bit clearer and to have a bigger effect in the second half. But I think that it wasn't all the players in the team certainly who were sort of lifted themselves. I think Jamie Carragher had a great quote when after they scored the third goal. He said it was the biggest involvement that Aubameyang had in the whole game was when he was celebrating. And that was his biggest influence on the game. So, and that also brings back the arguments about dropping him for the North London derby, because, if he's not going to be that influential in games, then in the managers, it's much easier for him to drop him.
So this is the thing. DW10 actually writing in saying, do Arsenal have an Aubameyang problem? And also, how much would it take to get Odegaard to sign? But on the Pierre-Emerick question, it's not just the lack of a contribution going forward. It's also the fact that, you know, with him, you're not going to get anything defensively either. You're going to leave whichever side it is with really no kind of cover at all.
Yeah, and especially when you're looking at the methodology that Arteta's trying to implement in there. It's, you know, you look at other managers with Tuchel, obviously with Pep. There's no sort of space for any luxury players or anybody who doesn't work within that framework. And, you know, if one part doesn't work, then it all falls down. And I think that's it's probably something that they're going to have to look at. And the thing that he's been using all the younger players, he knows that they will, more often than not, they will sort of take his directions on board and implement them to the letter if he wants. And if he's not going to get from that the older players, then they'll just have to take the hit on his wages and keep him on the bench.
Mm.
It's not as if they've got a history of giving £300,000 contracts to players that immediately look as if they don't. You know, you watch him today and you kind of wonder how he ever was a key player under Arteta, because he's kind of everything that Arteta, not rails against, but Arteta wants this kind of, you know, 11 workman with skill as the extra, but the passing, everything has to be perfect. And Aubameyang at the moment is just a moments player, you know, three moments in a match, one of them might lead to a goal, and you say, well, that's fine, you've done your job. But that's not really what Arteta's been preaching, so it's a strange one.
Do you think there was any moments hesitation before they agreed that contract when they thought, you know, is there anyone knocking around here that might be a salutary tale in this regard? No, I don't think so.
Do we feel like we're now at that kind of point, that that's the road we're on?
You know, I don't. Yeah,
pictures
I don't.
Of him in the with a sun umbrella in the stands and that kind of thing.
Well, as Daniel said, because of what Arteta wants, it's hard at the moment. It's hard to see where he does fit in. And again, I don't think it's as easy as also saying you can just not pick him and say, right, these are my principles, and he doesn't fit into those, because there will be, with this Arsenal team, there are going to be tough times too. And while he's there, it's not as easy as saying, okay, we're going to ignore the opportunity he has to give us those kind of special moments.
Yep, some big games between now and the end of the season. He could yet prove to be key. This could be another thing that I could be looking back at the end of the season saying, why? Why did I ever? Anyway, so now the Premier League weekend concluded Sunday night with Spurs and their trip to Aston Villa. Big question here, I think, for many people was, how would Spurs react to their week from hell, aka a normal 7 days in late period Mourinho management? They lost in the North London derby a week ago, and then Thursday night, possibly the nadir, although that might be optimistic, I'm not sure, of the defeat away at Dinamo Zagreb at the Maximir Stadium. But lo and behold, they went and came up with a coherent and compelling and convincing performance. Is that right? 2-0 away at Villa.
Convincing performance, but I think the graph is going, the line is going one way. I wouldn't say the crisis is over. I wouldn't say they've reached, I wouldn't even say Zagreb was the nadir. I think with Jose Mourinho, what we've learned from late Jose Mourinho is that things can always get worse. And I think that's the way it will go until you know, you have to, like, we know his capacity for making things toxic, and it hasn't, I don't think it's even, I think we're even at like 60% at this stage. Yeah.
But
there's a lot more to go. Like there's you know, more individual attacks, there's more players to be blamed, there's more poison to be spread around. Like it hasn't got going yet.
Dion, you mentioned the line of the graph, but at the moment it's pointing in quite a nice direction. They're only 3 points off the top four. And here's some good news. They don't have the distraction of a cup competition anymore. So I believe.
They were,
believe,
I mean,
you believe
they,
what?
They were competent against Villa. I mean, it was a poor start. And I think if Villa had scored first, you really feared for Spurs. But they basically didn't make any mistakes. And actually, I thought Lucas Moura was really good. Who is surely, I suspect, as of a few weeks ago, would have been by far the least popular member of that band of Spurs attackers. But he and the Carlos Vinicius were actually pretty good as a kind of surprise. I think they surprised Villa with the starting lineup. I mean, it felt like a late Mourinho, I'm now going to play the kids because this is my mesh to say I'm having to play the kids because I don't trust anyone else team. But Tanganga did pretty well. Moura was man of the match, and in Ndombele and Højbjerg, they have a very good central midfield partnership, which was too good for Grealish-less Villa, basically.
On the bench, there is an influence to have, to push the others. In training session, the same. Everyone has to be ready to push and make sure that he is ready to help the team when the moment will come. He's not only stay on your side and complain and... Because at the end, what we have to respect is this, is the badge.
David,
the
most important thing. Among players, among professionals, a speech like the one given by skipper Hugo Lloris after the Dinamo Zagreb exit, how will that have gone down, do you think?
Well, firstly, I think it's his prerogative as a captain to be able to say something like that. But quite often, it's the sort of the last throes of something that's happened behind the scenes. So, I mean, we saw in the documentary that that Mourinho started all of this sort of, all this thing in motion about them trying to make them sort of nastier players and nastier team. And so it's something that starts maybe in the middle of his reign or towards the end, started right at the very beginning. If anyone's to blame for the problems having in the dressing room or for what Hugo Lloris was pointing to after the game in Dynamo Zagreb, I think it's him that's cultivated that sort of atmosphere. And now, when he's sort of coming out and saying, oh, it's a disgrace, and things, that really reminded me of the, I don't remember the Scottish Cup final 1983. It's Sir Alex Ferguson. You know, they win the Cup 1-0, and he just comes out and slates him and says it's a disgrace, and that sort of standards we set. But he's coming at that from a position of power. Now, you turn that to Tottenham, where there's obviously problems behind the scenes. There's obviously not the same characters that have, that Sir Alex Ferguson had under him. And it can be a measured attack on them knowing you get a response. If you don't have the right characters in the dressing room, it's only going to go one way. It's only going to get more toxic. And you can see by as Lloris pointed to, the fringe players not contributing and not having the right attitudes when they're not in the starting 11. Then for me, and in my experience, that's just the beginning of the end. There's always things like this, whether it's from a player, from the captain, or from a manager. It just starts it all off.
Dion, what's your prediction for where next on this graph of yours?
Where next? Do you want me to? Well, it's not much of a prediction. It's just looking at history. I think there's just more poison to be released there, and more people to maybe turn on each other, more players to be scapegoated. I think what David says is interesting about the Lloris thing, because I think it's always a sort of a risky business when a player does that, because the minute you have people outside saying this is great to hear this honesty, I think the exact opposite reaction has been said within dressing rooms. Like, why is this guy coming out and making everybody praise him for his honesty? It's not so much they don't want the honesty. The idea that somebody should be getting the plaudits
right
for being honest, I think, is a damaging in a dressing room dynamic.
Lloris, who of course had that strange scene where he kind of ran up and attempted to have a go at Heung-min Son at halftime of a game, and Son, by all accounts, about the most beloved of figures within Spurs. Do you think would this have isolated Hugo Lloris then amidst the many factions within Spurs? Do you think, David?
Yeah, I can see that happening. You know, he's obviously, I always saw him as somebody who was very calm and measured the way he is on the pitch. And then you see those scenes in the dressing room. He's obviously more emotional than we've seen before. But when it comes, whether you're a captain or whether you're just the goalkeeper, it's immaterial. If you're going to come out and say things like that, you have to be, or your performances have to be flawless. Because as soon as you make a mistake, the other players will just jump on you, and then the fingers will start pointing, and you become a little bit of a hypocrite because you're not performing. And whether you've got a World Cup winners' medal or not, you know, I think the players won't. They won't see that in a great light.
Well, there you go, Spurs fans. You were celebrating a 2-0 win this weekend. Yeah. Anyway, well, so now that's where things stand at that end, or the sort of middle part of the table. But down at the bottom, two absolutely huge games in the Premier League this weekend. And let's get on to those next.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Yep, Friday night, it was Leeds winning at Fulham, and Saturday, that Brighton 3-0 win over Newcastle, which, Daniel, you were very excited to talk about.
Yeah, for both reasons. Brighton, I thought, you know, Graham Potter has not come in for some stick this season, sort of the opposite, in that he probably feels a little bit embarrassed at the amount of praise that Brighton have had when he knows that the situation has actually got to almost an emergency. But he just got it absolutely spot on against Newcastle. He picked Welbeck and Mopay as centre-forwards without the ball. And then as soon as they got the ball, those two strikers kind of drifted left and right and Trossard just burst through the middle. And then the other thing he did was have these kind of non-natural wing-backs in Jacob Moda and Pascal Gross, who, because Welbeck and Mopay were providing the width, they just tucked inside and just, again, stormed through the middle. And I think he basically thought, Newcastle are going to sacrifice possession, they're going to invite us on, so we can try and do things a little bit differently here and try and unnerve them. Because if we do regulation stuff, Steve Bruce's Newcastle are, if they are anything, it's that they can defend against things they're expecting. And Bruce, after the game, and I thought it was funny, it's the third year in a row that Bruce has faced Brighton, and he said they surprised us and we didn't really know how to cope.
I was absolutely shocked at basically Brighton being that far in front of us in every department tonight. They beat them 3-0 at St James's in September as well. Where was he that day?
Yeah, it's but to be fair, I mean, no, not to be fair, but Brighton have played a different way in each game.
Okay.
I don't think how passive Newcastle were in the first half, I don't think it would have mattered if Brighton had played with nine and played them all in midfield, to be honest. But just doing things differently, it did kind of, you know, emphasise just how different these two clubs are in terms of, I mean, they're basically the opposites of each other. One is a club where hope is being created and another is a place where hope's going to die, basically. So they couldn't be more opposite.
Right. Newcastle starting passively, but then, of course, when Brighton scored, they had to come out of their shells and attack the game, except they just didn't for the entire 90 minutes. Why? What was the point of it all? It was extraordinary. It's an international break, which has overtones for clubs that might be looking at their managerial positions and the wisdom of continuing with the incumbents and that kind of thing. Is there any likelihood, any imminence of a change?
They say not. I mean, Sky Sports, who have always been pretty close to the Ashley situation, reporting that they don't plan to make a change. And from the Sky Sports report, said because of Bruce's loyalty to Ashley and passion for the club, which if there were any Newcastle supporters not riled up by the situation at the moment, I'm not sure Bruce will be thanking them for saying, you know, at least he's loyal to Ashley. That isn't how to curry favour in the northeast at the moment. So, yeah, it's pretty bleak.
All right. Banners on the streets of Newcastle after that defeat, calling for him to go. True faith, calling Bruce the fraudy Geordie, in a memorable turn of phrase. They were 10 points clear of the bottom three in February, Newcastle. They are now, well, still 2 points ahead of Fulham, but of course they finished the season at Fulham. Oh my word, that's going to be huge. They got a brutal run, but before that they've got Spurs, West Ham, Liverpool, Arsenal, Leicester and Man City. So, anyway, Fulham, meantime, entertained Leeds on Friday evening. Leeds returning to your weekend's winners section, Daniel, I imagine.
Yeah, Patrick Bamford as well, who missed out on an England call-up last week and had been touted for one. Again, scored and assisted despite limping around for most of the first half. Easy to forget that he played for five Premier League clubs before this season and scored a single goal, and now has, you know, he's the second highest scoring Englishman in the Premier League this season, which is some turnaround.
It's remarkable, isn't it? He thanked his teammates for doing a lot of my running after the final whistle, which was nice. Leeds 2-1 winners. They could have had more as well. Two goals ruled out for offside. It was a particular shame that Luke Ayling's goal was cancelled because the celebration was magnificent. David.
Bar robbing us of good celebrations, eh?
Yeah.
Well, we still have the celebration. We just don't have the goal. The goal doesn't exist, but the celebration will never be taken away from us.
That's very true. Can I get in early for a Fulham backlash if anyone's starting one of those? That's three defeats in four now for Scott Parker's side. They've lost 10 of their last 16 at home. Is there a case to be made that he should be doing better?
Yeah, it feels like you're not allowed to. They'll put you in prison these days for saying that Fulham should be playing better. But they're just not good enough in the final third. You know, Dos Magia scored twice on his debut and hasn't scored since. And Mitrovic, I think, has scored once in the Premier League this season. And the one that's disappointed me is Loftus-Cheek, because I thought this might be a real breakout season on loan from Chelsea. Kind of this, it felt like everything was right. Still in London, in the Premier League, regular starts. And he was meant to be that link between attack and defence, and it just hasn't really happened. And yeah, I still think they'll probably go down, which is completely
really
against all, even with all that narrative. Yeah,
even with that final day game against Newcastle, do you think it'll be out of their sight by the time they get there, or
maybe,
that Newcastle
yeah.
will spring us? Wow, crikey! Because it was just 2-1 this, and there was that moment when Ademola Lookman had the miss, and then Leeds immediately went down the other end and scored. So fine margins and all of that. At Leeds, anyway, with the victory. Of course, the club in mourning this weekend after the death of Peter Lorimer, which they announced on Saturday morning. Club legend, of course, at Leeds. A name that rang out in playgrounds across the country back in the 70s, courtesy of his extraordinary lash. I think it was once clocked at 107 miles per hour. But part as well, David, of one of the all-time iconic FA Cup moments, which I know will be close to your heart as a Sunderland fan, the double save.
Leeds are really pushing forward. Terry, brilliant save. And Lorimer makes it 1-1. No. Astonishing.
Jimmy Montgomery was actually my first goalkeeping coach and my youth team coach at Sunderland. And I always teased him, said if he caught the first one, I wouldn't have been in the knee for the other saves. But it's an iconic save, and of course, it's probably not Pete Lorimer's finest moment. But it's part of goalkeeping history, that's it.
It is remarkable. I mean, watching it back now, without the angles, you know, without the different camera angles, it's very hard to understand what laws of physics are involved in the ball not going into the net. And Lorimer is completely befuddled by the fact that he hasn't just equalised. But anyway, extraordinary power in his foot.
Do you know what? I was listening to Bob Wilson, and he was talking about every time that he faced him, he faced him a lot during the 60s and 70s. And he said that when he got the ball within maybe 30 yards of the goal, he knew the ball was coming at him. And he said no other player struck the ball like him. And it was almost, he could feel the fear inside him when he touched the ball at his feet to shoot. His shot was that hard. On top of that, he was a brilliant, brilliant player. And for all the goals he scored as well, he wasn't a striker, was he? He was a winger. And for somebody to have that sort of that build and that sort of that connection with the football, you don't associate that with wingers, do you?
It's a quaint thing as well. I know it's almost a cliche now when you look back at his career, but how long, you know, his association with Leeds as a player was, you know, from the early 60s to, you know, going back and finishing there in 84 or 85. And then I interviewed him once in his pub in Leeds, you know, and it was like, again, it is a cliche, but this idea that this great figure of the club, this huge figure in the history of the club, is running a pub, as a friend of mine described it, as a lively spot, he said it was. You know, that's how you could describe the pub. I went in there on a Friday afternoon to kind of interview him, and it was, you know, it was packed, and it was that kind of a place. And there's Peter Lorimer working behind the bar in the pub, and that's, you know, and that was the way, you know, he gave himself to the club, and he was a part of the city. So when someone like that dies, I think it does, it has a real profound effect. Again, it's one of those, you know, there's so many reasons to kind of to mourn things apart from even the death of people, but to mourn aspects of football that we don't have this year. And when you think about how he would be remembered if Elland Road was full, it's kind of sad that you don't actually get to have that this year.
Mm, that's very true. How did your interview go?
Very great. He was great. He was lovely. You know, it was very hard to get in this lively spot. It was very hard to find somewhere where you could actually talk quietly to somebody. But he was a lovely man. And but he was just one of these people who was kind of committed to Leeds in every sense.
Well, Peter Lorimer, who passed away on Saturday. Now, very, very shortly, we're going to be talking about internationals. England are favourites for the Euros, says Daniel Story. You can hear his thoughts on that very, very shortly. Also, Ireland, perhaps also favourites, I'm not sure, from Dion Fanning. First of all, though, let's get some odds from Carl Monaghan from Paddy Power.
Hello, James. Hello, listeners. We are down to the last four in the FA Cup, and the market is as follows. Man City, 4-5. Leicester, 16-5. Chelsea, 7-2. And Southampton, 9-1. The same amount of goals, 9. Leicester put past the Saints a couple of years ago in the Premier League. But after Dion Dublin pulled out Southampton to play the winners of Leicester and Man United, you can be sure Brendan Rodgers was licking his lips. And there will be plenty of takers now on Leicester at 16-5 to lift the cup. While City's quadruple credentials will certainly be firmly tested by Thomas Tuchel's well-oiled blues in the other Wembley semi. In terms of the Champions League, Manchester City, no surprise, are top of the pile there at 2-1. Next up for them is Dortmund, and what is a brilliant draw for the purists. Erling Haaland is the apple of every club in Europe's eye and will surely be watched very closely as City look to find the heir to Aguero's soon-to-be vacated throne. Second in the betting lurks the holders, Bayern Munich at 7-2, and Lewandowski and co. may not be the relentless juggernaut that they were last season, but Bayern have looked like their old selves of late and will be a stern test for Pox PSG, but value tends to find the brave, listeners, and PSG's brushing aside of Barca with ease was worth taking note of. So if you think Mbappe and Neymar hold the keys to unlocking this year's competition, you may like the look of the French giants at 8-1. In the Europa League, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's last chance of getting his mittens on some silverware this season continues, and it's his Red Devils who are the favourites at 13-8. They had their chances certainly enhanced when Jose's Spurs decided to capitulate in Zagreb in midweek. United also got the plum draw, Granada from Spain, and face Ajax or Roma in the last four if they progress. Arsenal fans and many neutrals will fancy the Gunners at 3-1, and there'll be plenty of takers. Arteta's men are second favourites to lift the trophy now. They need it for Champions League qualification, remember. But they have to get past Slavia Prague, whose bite is worse than their bark. Just ask Brendan Rodgers. But Brendan won't mind, though. He'll be picking out a nice new suit for his trip to Wembley next month.
You can find out those odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply. And when the fun stops, stop. Totally Football League Show is out on Monday, and it'll be followed on Tuesday by a welter of podcasts. You've got the Totally Scottish Football Show, which will be discussing Old Firm things and lots of other things as well. The Offside Rule WSL edition, that'll be out as well. And the Totally Football Show European edition, which will be a busy one, discussing the Europa League draw, the Champions League draw, of course, and loads of action from this weekend. I don't know if you saw Armand Lorientais' remarkable free kick, which has caused much debate about the nature of a good free kick or not. Anyway, this is what the French commentator thought.
Va frapper directement et il va trouver la lucarne. Armand Lorientais, le coup franc pour l'égalisation. Il en avait mis un contre Saint-Étienne.
We hear if Julien Laurent is equally enthusiastic. In Tuesday's show, we'll also be discussing Juve losing at home to Super Pippo's Benevento and many other top stories. But anyway, speaking of football abroad, internationals. World Cup qualifiers start on Wednesday, which is nice. That's for the World Cup. Euro 2020 is happening this summer, we're told. And I see, Daniel, you wrote this week that England are pre-tournament favourites. You said it was as weird as seeing your school teacher when you're out with your mates or a 7-foot NBA player dressed in a suit. So on the kind of scale of weirdness, that's the point we're at.
Yeah, I mean, I should say that's not an opinion that England are pre-tournament favourites. That's a fact that England are pre-tournament favourites, okay. Both with bookmakers in the UK and abroad as well. Sometimes there's a bit of bias, UK bias. But yeah, they are, which is, I think, is weird. I think France have got the better squad and won the last major tournament. But that's the nature of it. And the column I wrote was just basically saying that, well, two things. Firstly, that this is a huge summer for Gareth Southgate. And secondly, that there's this kind of notion that the thing for him to do would be just to throw all the kids on and go and attack a tournament, which is all very well saying that. But then that's the sort of thing that leads to turnip headlines when you then crash out in the last 16 because you got picked off on the counter by Germany and lost 4-0 or something. But right. Yeah, you can't do that. You look at recent international tournaments and it's a lot more guarded than that these days. There isn't any Brazil 1970s anymore.
Daniel, you are Gareth Southgate. What's the first item on your agenda?
Well, to bringing David into the conversation, I think the goalkeeping situation is the biggest question. I think it's probably the only absolute question mark in his squad, in terms of I still don't think he knows who's going to be number one this summer.
Who should it be, David?
Well, that's a big question for him, isn't it? I think, you know, looking back to the World Cup in 2018, we went in that tournament with not really a definite number one. Obviously, Jordan Pickford did play and it played very well. Now, and I think we could have done with a little bit more stability this time. But he does have it's a nice problem to have, where he's got two other goalkeepers in Nick Pope and Dean Henderson, who were, now Henderson's playing regularly. Obviously, Pope is playing well regularly. And he's got three different goalkeepers that he can choose from if he wanted to, for his horses for courses. You know, I keep going back to this idea of, if you're playing in against the side who you're going to have more possession, then maybe you can have Jordan Pickford in goal. If you're going to progress further in the tournament, you're going to concede a lot of possession to teams, get somebody who's used to being in a position like that, like Nick Pope at Burnley, and play him in those games. But of course, this injury to Pickford, it throws everything up in the air again, and that's what you don't really want. You don't want this kind of uncertainty going into the tournament, and I think it'll be really interesting to see who he goes with. Now that Dean Henderson's obviously getting the regular football that he needs, and over the next 2 weeks, certainly with Manchester United career, it's going to be defining, really, because if Solskjaer sticks with him or goes back to David De Gea, that's going to be a big question mark back at club level. But yeah, Henderson and Pope, it's a big question who's going to play it. And I think Nick Pope's probably deserved it.
Yeah, you think Pope? You would pick Pope if you were Gareth Southgate?
Yeah, at the moment. And I think that, of course, Dean Henderson's playing well, but it's over a short period of time. And Nick Pope's proved week in, week out over the course of the season, he's ready for it. And like I said, I think you can choose between two goalkeepers, two different types of goalkeepers, depending on the game. And you know, this might be a chance. This might be a chance to do it. You know, for one of the games, play one keeper, and then the other game, play for the next one.
I think that's really interesting that what David says about that. You know, it hadn't struck me that if you're going to be out of possession against a Germany or a France, maybe you pick a goalkeeper who plays for Burnley and therefore they don't have much possession. We've never really seen that at international football before. You know, I know Tim Krul got brought on for penalties, but that's about as far as it's gone in terms of picking specialists for the opponents. But it makes complete sense when you think about it. If you know, if you play for a team that dominates the ball and suddenly you're not seeing the ball for 10-15 minutes, then that must be hard for a goalkeeper.
Yeah, very true. Dion,
yes.
Republic of Ireland won't be featuring in Euro 2020/1. But there's a brand new set of qualifiers for World Cup, which is exciting. Republic, how are you getting on under Stephen Kenny? He said, knowing the answer.
When you asked before the show what was anything we wanted to talk about, I was going to flag that maybe I didn't want to talk about Ireland, but it is a new group of games, new opponents to not score against.
Republic haven't scored since Kenny's first game in charge.
That's right. Haven't scored in seven games.
Right. Yeah,
play Serbia on Wednesday.
Yes. And then host Luxembourg, and then you play Qatar
in Hungary.
In Hungary. Well, yep. Surely you can score a goal against one of those teams.
You would like to think so, yeah. But we would like to think that by the time Qatar comes around, Ireland might get a goal. But
the World Cup, or...?
Well, the World Cup, I don't think that Ireland will be there. I feel like when I'm on, you know, on this, I have to kind of give some, it's like when a government minister appears, not I'm comparing myself to a government minister, but when they go on a foreign TV show, they need to actually, you know, speak up for their country. But I find it hard to do that. No, it's going to be very tough. This could be a pretty, defining week for Stephen Kenny already. I think there's a lot of grumblings. Because things have gone so badly, there's been other stuff. You know, Damien Duff, who's part of the coaching staff, has left the coaching staff whilst professing his loyalty to Kenny. He expressed some frustration about the FAI, and there's a sense that things aren't, you know, various elements of the setup could be under pressure. The Serbia game looks a daunting one. There's more players out this weekend. Caoimhín Kelleher, Liverpool goalkeeper, is out. So Mark Travers, I think, at Bournemouth is going to start. There's some more, three or four players out again this weekend. And that looks like about five years ago, I think it was, Martin O'Neill's Ireland played Serbia in Belgrade in a 2-2 draw in one of the most ridiculously bad games I've ever seen. And Ireland would take that now. But I think if they don't get anything there, and Luxembourg, again, Ireland would be expected to win there. And if they didn't, I think it could be, there'd be an awful lot of pressure on Kenny at that stage.
Is it just a managerial issue with Republic, or are there other factors? Like, I don't know, are they not aggressively targeting people with the right grandparents anymore?
We've talked about two players in this show, Nathan Redmond and Patrick Bamford, who at times were sort of courted by Ireland managers. It doesn't. The main problem is the quality of the players. Stephen Kenny has got an idea of how he wanted Ireland to play, which is progressive, and I agree with what he wants to do with the team. The years under Trapattoni and Martin O'Neill were, to my mind, kind of wasted years in many ways because of the way Ireland played and the pointlessness. I think international football at a much higher level, England have demonstrated kind of what it needs to be about. It's got to give something to a country that feels that there's something aspirational to it, something that a country can be proud of, rather than, I think, what happened under O'Neill and Trapattoni, kind of random good results surrounded by incredible dross and, you know, a football that you really didn't want to watch. Like, you know, I've been at some of the Ireland games you watch, especially under Trapattoni, but under O'Neill as well, where you think, this is not, why would anybody want to willingly go and watch this? And Kenny is trying to change that, and he's a thoughtful manager. But again, because his background is primarily in the League of Ireland, people question, or he's open to being questioned about his pedigree in terms of, is he the right manager for international football? So there are bigger problems, much bigger problems than the manager in terms of players. You know, when you talk about players, they didn't get Declan Rice, didn't get Jack Grealish, who both played underage for Ireland. If they had those players, it would be a totally different story. But it comes back to the manager. The manager will be the person who gets it one way or the other.
Well, there's some exciting fixtures on the way. England with Albania. You've got Wales against Belgium. Thursday sees Northern Ireland take on Roberto Mancini's Italy. And we'll be, you know, discussing a lot of those kind of things in Thursday's show, as well as having the return of the Intertotally Cup. So I'm not sure who's featuring in this opening round, or indeed whether Daniel will be returning to the competition after the pain of last year's defeat in the final. But it's going to be a cracker, whoever's there. And I do hope you'll be joining us for that, listener. For now, though, it's many, many thanks to Dion Fanning, to David Priest, and to Daniel Story and producer Charlie, and you, listener. Anything you want to add, David, Daniel, Dion, before we wrap it up?
Just time to get my pyjamas on now.
All right, then. Lovely. Or take them off for you, perhaps, listener, it now being Monday morning. You're now free to continue with your week. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll catch you soon. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Keep up to date with everything Totally at thetotallyfootballshow.com and follow us at The Totally Show on Twitter and Insta. Check out all of the Athletic's football podcasts on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual places, or listen ad-free on the Athletic app. The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.